Now, detonate the reality bomb!
I will build a great, great wall.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The truth is out there.
The military-industrial complex.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know.
Change has come to America.
Catapult of propaganda.
From a secure location on top of the ridge in the heart of the beautiful Missouri Ozarks, this is a view from the bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
Many Christians will say that the topic of this discussion will be unnecessary, that it's fringe, that it's sensationalist. But in truth, the subject matter of our conversation today is at the very heart of the mission of Jesus. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. Joining me is a gentleman who refers to himself as a Christian contrarian, and we'll ask about that. And he's got a book that tracks with much of the research that I have done, but he gets into more of the secret society aspect than I have done. It's a topic that pops up here frequently on A View from the Bunker, and we're glad to make his acquaintance because this is long overdue. We've had many of you listeners, and thank you for continuing to prod me and remind me until I finally got around to asking him to be on the program. For the first time, the author of The Genesis 6 Conspiracy, How Secret Societies and the Descendants of Giants Plan to Enslave Humankind. It is our honor to welcome Gary Wayne to the program. Gary, welcome.
Well, so happy to be here and to join you and to talk about some of our, I think, the audience will probably already knows might be some common research, and really looking forward to the discussion today.
Well, me too. And again, it's overdue because people have been asking me for ever since your book came out now, why don't you have Gary Wayne on the program? And it's because I tend to get distracted by shiny objects, I think. So the book, The Genesis 6 Conspiracy, puts it right there in the title. First of all, how long has the book been out? Has this been out even a year?
Yeah, it's been out about a year and a half or so.
Okay.
So
I'm really slow on this.
Pardon me?
So I'm really slow in getting this getting on the program.
I guess I'm a little bit unlike most other authors in this genre, or, you know, I don't have a platform or a show or anything, and it's the first book that I've written, and I come at it from a little bit different perspective. So I've been building sort of my audience and trying to reach out to my potential customers and get the information out. And so it's been a process to keep going. And, things keep getting better all of the time as I do more shows and mm-hmm. as more people buy my books. So
well, it's
starting to get some very good response.
Well, it's to your credit that people have heard you on other programs and have said you really need to talk to him. I know Justin Fall of Fourth Watch, who was here visiting us in the Ozarks just 4 or 6 weeks ago, has you on as a regular guest, and I've been listening to his podcast lately and really enjoying the conversation. So, credit to Justin there as well for being a little more on the ball when it comes to this sort of thing. And let me ask you about this Christian contrarian. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, let me explain that, and also let me throw a thank you out to Justin. He did my first interviews and first podcast. So yeah, I'll do as many shows as Justin wants in honor and appreciation of what he does and the good work that he does. So as a contrarian, I come at things, not from a status quo perspective, whether or not it's from secular history or from biblical theology. And I like to find out for myself what the Bible says or what research is out there and connect things from that perspective. And because I came back to Christianity, in my 20s, and actually it was Hal Lindsey who brought me back with his great Planet Earth book, and I had to figure out whether or not what he was saying was actually in the Bible or not.
Right,
and that
sure.
sort of sent me on the quest back to God. And so I decided I would read the Bible for myself and log as much of it as I could into different narratives and make sense out of the Bible. And so in doing that, some of my conclusions are a little bit different or from a different perspective, but I always do things as what from a measurement against what the Bible says. So even if I'm doing research into secret societies and using their legends and their belief systems or other religions, which I do extensively in my book, I always measure things back to what it says in the Bible and try and make it clear to reader, this is what they believe. It's not necessarily what I believe, but it's important to understand what they believe. So it comes at it from a contrarian perspective, from that ideology as not being from the status quo.
Mm. Well, let's dive right in. Again, the title of the book, The Genesis 6 Conspiracy, and of course, listeners to this program, viewers now on YouTube at youtube.com/Derek Gilbert will know Genesis 6 refers to Genesis 6 verses 1 through 4. There were giants in the earth in those days. These are the men of renown, etc. When the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were fair and took wives, women of all that they chose, and from them came the Nephilim. How do you view this situation? I mean, a lot of Christians will look at this and say, that can't possibly be because angels don't marry in heaven.
Right. And I think that's a very, very good position to start from. But I would note that for the first point of what it says in Matthew, with whom you're referring to there, is talking about heaven, and it's not talking about earth.
In heaven.
And we understand angels as being immortal beings from, you know, created from fire and are, you know, were there since almost the beginning of creation. And they have no need to reproduce, right? They have no need to repopulate. And if we take it from Revelation that there were 100 million angels created and a third of them fell away, then there was a lot of angels created.
Mm.
Depending on which orders, but still 100 million is what Revelation tells us. So, and then when we look at what Genesis says, as and in connection with some of the other scripture in the Bible, let's say whether or not we're talking about you know, 2 Peter or we're talking about 1 Jude, we're clearly getting an understanding that something happened in prehistory where angels sinned. And somehow these giants were created in Genesis 6, right? So there's this understanding then that somehow angels have this trans dimension ability that seems to permit them to take a different form if they choose in this world.
Hmm.
And so if you take the word habitation, that's in Jude 1:6, for example, that's the word oikotarian. And that means a dwelling place for the spirit. And then if you go back to 2 Corinthians, it talks about in verse 5, the only other place where the word oikotarian is used as for this dwelling place in heaven, that, and it's talking about taking on and putting on clothes. So it seems to indicate just from that perspective that there's a body in heaven and a body in the earth, and that somehow they can take a form of their choosing. Now if we match that up with accounts of angels in the Bible, we see they take different shapes and forms. You have mm-hmm. shining beings, giant beings. You have ones that look identical to men. You have Satan being called a serpent and a dragon, as well as being part of the seraphim out of Isaiah 6. And so just without citing every biblical application, you understand that they take different forms. And in some cases, they look like men, but somehow they're still identified as angels. So there seems to be this sort of shape-shifting sort of capability that they have when they come here. And then if you look at Genesis 6, somehow they're able to produce offspring with human females that produce a superhuman form, a hybrid being. And, you know, giant is not something that would be produced from a human mating with a human,
mm-hmm.
unless there's some sort of DNA alteration that's going on, that's certainly not included. So just putting all of those together suggests that angels can take a different form. And if you go from outside sources, this is not biblical, but if you go from outside sources like Enoch, I mean, they certainly say that the angels, the 200 watchers, went to human females on Mount Hermon and had sex with the daughters of men to produce the children. And if you go to other religions, they have this concept of this changeling ability, which is their term, changeling, or shapeshifter. That's a very occultic, polytheist term. And even from Jewish Kabbalism, they believe that the angels had this shape-shifting capability, and not only could they choose any form they wanted, they could choose any sex that they wanted.
Hmm.
So there's a lot of circumstantial evidence, but when you look at Genesis 6, unless you discount the sons of God as being angels, then one presumes that they had the ability to produce children because it clearly says that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the Bible means what it says and says what it means, and there are other places in Scripture where they clearly have physicality when they visit Abraham and eat a meal, for example.
Yes.
There's nothing in the text that would indicate that they are not capable of producing these, of having physical relations. The Greeks, for example, and other cultures, certainly the Babylonians, had an idea that these pre-flood men of renown and the knowledge that they possessed was a good thing. Certainly the Babylonians were very proud in the post-flood era of the preservation of pre-flood knowledge. Gilgamesh was called the master or lord of the Apkallu being the Mesopotamian word for the watchers. The idea there that they were able to preserve and bring back this pre-flood information. The Greeks, Hesiod in his works, Theogony and Works and Days, referred to a race of men that he called the Merope's Anthropoi, the men of the golden age ruled by Kronos, who, of course, was the leader of the Titans, who were thrust down to Tartarus just like these angels who sinned, according to 2 Peter. They seemed a very positive view, the Greeks, the Babylonians, of these men of the golden age, the pre-flood era, ruled by the watchers, these angels who walked among us. Why then do we Christians and Jews have this negative view? And second part of this question, how is their negative influence being manifested today? Why should we care?
Why should we care? It's a very, very good question. And typically we only get information out of the secular side or the polytheist religions in terms of their mythology and the entertainment that they produced that
right,
the giants
right.
were good.
Yeah.
But that's not the case. In fact, if you go into pretty much all of the legends and that these demigods, and they were known as demigods because they were, and in polytheism, just so the audience knows, is that a hero or a man of renown or a hero as in Theogony that you talked about, and mm-hmm. The Greek writers called them heroes, essentially the same meaning. A demigod and a hero were the same thing in the ancient understanding, and that a hero was the offspring of a god and a human female, right? And therefore, we need to understand that they're talking about the same account that the Bible is, but from a polytheist perspective, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we dig into, let's say, somebody like Plato, who gives the account of Atlantis in Timaeus and Critias, he talks about Poseidon, so a god or a fallen angel. It mates with Clymene and known by a few other names and produces these 10 Titan kings that are going to rule the Atlantean Empire and are going to try and assert itself into world dominion, which mm-hmm. they're checked by the Athenians, so another civilization in the Greek account. So what's going on here is that they come in as a judicial rulers and they're good, but somehow the human part starts to take control and they become more evil as they go.
Mm.
And then they start to rebel against the gods, and then they start to rebel against the earth and slaughter and oppress. And Enoch is filled with these accounts from mm-hmm. a more monotheist perspective than from the polytheist perspective. And there's actually wars between the giants, so that Zeus, who is going to try and stop the rebellion by the Titans, actually will draft Hercules and Theseus as a couple examples to fight against these evil giants, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you see the story that's going on. Yeah, the good and the evil, the good
Nephilim against the bad Nephilim, huh?
Yeah, and that's a constant of that sort of part of the dualism of polytheism as well. You have like dark elves and light elves. You have white magic. You have black magic.
Mm-hmm,
and that's
mm-hmm.
sort of part of that belief system. So it matches in with that sort of mythology. But at the end of the day, all of these giants, they turn more and more evil as they go. And thus the gods have to bring on the flood. And in many other accounts, more of a conflagration of events, more than just the flood, but the flood is a key part. But there's volcanoes and meteors and a whole bunch of other things that are going on with the flood catastrophe.
Mm-hmm. So it's when we see these stories, and one of the reasons I subtitled my book Satan's PSYOPs from Eden to Armageddon, you know, PSYOP just a like a disinformation campaign, is that it seems like a lot of these stories, whether we're reading them from Greek mythology or from the Mesopotamian accounts, are transmitting the same story but from a completely different worldview, almost like watching Fox News and Al Jazeera on reporting on the same story. How do we identify when we're looking at these stories of the say the giants? Because the Bible itself gives us very little information. We have to go to the Enochian literature, like the Book of Enoch and Jasher and Jubilees, to find out more. How do we sift through that to get the truth compared to what we're getting from Greek mythology and say Babylonian and Akkadian sources?
And that is such a good question, because in the Bible we don't really get told which civilization they were part of, or how many civilizations. Was there one?
Right.
Were there as many as nine, or were there seven, or were there four? And of course, that's part of the inconsistency of trying to sift through prehistory. So first of all, we don't even know which civilization.
Mm-hmm.
But when we look at the polytheist versions or the polytheist corruptions, depending on which lens you want to look through, and to me, the ends are still the same. There are clear markers as to what to be aware of. So we're either having two different things going on: parallel accounts from a polytheist perspective, or a corruption of the monotheist perspective. And I'll leave that up to each individual to decide which one that is. But look for the markers of the pantheon, right? And in the pantheon, you're going to have multiple gods. And you're going to have typically two gods, one that is to help humankind, and mm-hmm. one is against humankind. And then from the polytheist pantheon, they invert it so that they turn the god of the Bible into, let's say, from the Sumerian that you were talking about, that would be Enlil, mm-hmm. who causes the flood and who is the evil god, and Enki, who is his counterpart in this dualistic good versus evil religion of polytheism, is the god that helps humankind, gives them knowledge, helps save them and warn them from the ark. And so you see those clear markers that are going on. And the other thing to look at, which comes out very, very clear in anything that's other than the Bible, is you have this partnership between these gods, fallen angels as we would understand them, kings, which are the Nephilim, Titans, Anunnaki, Datiria, Assyria, all these other names, Maitos, from the Chinese, all around the world that ruled. And you have this partnership with this polytheist religion, right, that takes shape, that creates this organizational structure of these different civilizations, if we can believe that there was more than one civilization. And there's also a partnership with the descendants of Cain, particularly as you get into the Freemasons, because they take their patriarchs right back to the same period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And they look at Cain as learning the seven sacred sciences from God, from Adam, who learned them in Eden. And just as Adam will teach that to Cain and Abel, Abel is slaughtered by Cain, he will also teach it to Seth. But Cain does something different with this knowledge. He uses the knowledge to rebel and lead people away from God, and to discredit God and not give him credit as being the creator of the universe, and to celebrate the fallen angels in a new pantheon. And then Enoch, son of Cain, and understand there's two Enochs,
right?
One son of Cain and one son of Jared, two different ones. Both are important. Both wrote scripture, and you have to be able to discern which is which. And according to the Freemasons, Enoch develops mysticism and the secret societies from these sacred, from the seven sacred sciences, which then partners with the fallen angels and additional illicit knowledge and the Nephilim that they create. So you have this usurping of the kingship, which comes with the Nephilim. And again, in some polytheism, they'll take some of the descendants of Cain as being kings before that. So still from that sort of concept where you don't have kings in the Sethian line,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
More as a shepherd concept. And so it's this organizational structure of Titan Nephilim kings usurping control over the antediluvian world and imposing the polytheist religion over the antediluvian world and then developing the sciences to an extraordinary level. And all of this is going on. And when you want to hear about the sciences in this partnership, look at magic, because that's part of it, right? That's part of developing of the sciences. And the wizards, like the Merlin-type wizard or the Lord of the Rings-type wizard, that would be the priesthood in antediluvian society, just as they would be part of the magi after the flood or the priests in Egypt religion. And so you see this organizational structure that was designed to enslave humankind because these beings are being replaced, are being put on the earth by the fallen angels to ensure humankind is not going to rise in the next world to be raised higher than the fallen angels. And probably as well as an example to justify their own rebellion, the fallen angel rebellion. So that was a bit of a mouthful. I got on a bit of a rant, but
But
you, context in here.
As you can see, I'm sitting here and I'm taking notes while we're talking because you're connecting a lot of dots. And now, again, in my book, The Great Inception, I tried to stick with what I could find from peer-reviewed secular scholars.
Yes.
And filter that through a biblical lens. And that still comes up with some really, really interesting stuff, especially when you marry it with what you've come up with here. Justin, when I was on Justin Fall's program here just a little while ago, he mentioned the Sumerian god Enki. And kudos to him for paying attention, because I think the god Enki, the Sumerian god Enki, is a lot more important in human history than we have been taught. And I want to ask you about your take and your research into him in just a second, but let me throw this at you. The Egyptologist David Roll.
Yes, I like him.
Yeah, has
a lot.
put forward a lot of information that is speculative. His fellow scholars don't accept a lot of what he teaches, but I think he's on the right track.
Yes, and he has a different chronology too, which I also like his chronology.
Yeah. He suggests, and he's not the first to do this, but he suggests that the first city that was built, the Mesopotamians remember it as the city of Eridu, which was, of course, the home city of Enki. It was built by Enki. Yes. That was where his temple was located. He suggests that it was either built by Cain for his son Enoch, or it was built by Enoch for his son Erad, whose name etymologically is very similar to this name, Eridu, which then leads a whole new significance to Cain bringing these seven sacred sciences, including magic, to Eridu, because Enki was the god of magic and sorcery. So
and the god of wisdom, and also was identified at, you know, in terms of the glyphs and things as the serpent, right? So again, you got all of this, and the sign of wisdom as well, right?
Yeah,
and the
bringer
of knowledge,
and the one who created the Apkallu, the watchers, who then brought this to the earth. So we've got some interesting threads running through this ancient city of Eridu. So you're researching Enki now. What do you know, and when did you know it? Why is Enki so significant in human history, and why don't we 21st century Christians know anything about him?
Well, I think it's because they want to be able to reveal their knowledge, and I'm talking about secret societies and the mystical religions. They want to control the timetable on information and when they reveal what. Because if you get to the understanding of who they, in Gnostic religions and in the secret societies, understand Enki is, they understand them as Satan or as Lucifer, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the god of the Freemasons. As you get into the adept level, you understand that they're worshiping the great architect of the universe or Lucifer. Mm-hmm. And Enki in Sumerian mythology, you know, you got Ki, which is earth, and En, which is Lord, right?
Right. God of this world.
Yeah, he's the god of this world, right? Yeah. And so when John speaks of that, I mean, that's exactly what it's being talked about. So they don't want to put too much of a light on who Satan is, who is also the great serpent,
right?
And so I think it's a designed ideology that they want to keep as much of that controlled. And so if you understand that Satan in a seraphic form or the seraphim form would be a serpent type being, right?
Very glowing, very radiant.
Very in radiant as well.
Seraph essentially means, or seraphim essentially means burning ones.
Yes.
And it's used
actually fiery serpent as well, as you connect both of those definitions for it.
Right.
Just as you get into Numbers 21 with Moses in the desert, where you have these snakes that are attacking the Israelites.
Right.
In all of the words utilizing the snakes, they use the word nakash. But for the spear that Moses is going to use and the serpent that he's going to put on top that's going to help heal the Israelites, that is referred to as a seraphim.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
So you get a clear understanding that these seraphim angels had the face of a viper. And what's also interesting, as I'll connect in the book, is I believe that, and as descriptions that you get in other cultures of what the Nephilim looked like, they also had the face of the viper in early generations.
Hmm.
They looked like their parents. And so, when we look at Enki, he's also known as, Samael in Sumerian mythology and in Hebrew mysticism as well.
Hmm.
And from the city of Sama, where Samael, El of Sama is mm-hmm. how you would get that connection. And that was, Sama was in northern Mesopotamia. So again, very, very central to, a little bit further north than where those seven ancient cities of Sumeria was, but definitely in the same region. And again, it's when we connect back into some of the ancient religions, you have the Persian tradition of Zoroastrianism, which is believed to go back to be part of this religion that, extending religion that Enoch, the evil son of Cain, created through mysticism. They looked at Samael as called Ormazd, meaning serpent of the night. And so you have this consistency of this serpentry imagery through the high gods Zarathustra, as they called them at that time, if I pronounced that right. Sometimes I murder some of the words. and also the Persian god Ahura Mazda.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And, of course, the Mazda tradition is a sort of a serpent tradition of kings in Sumeria. And then if you look at around the world, you've got all of these serpent imageries and dragon imageries around the world
mm-hmm.
of gods and kings.
Yeah,
right?
I've got an old book that I need to read that I've downloaded. It's in the public domain. But you're right. It is a global phenomenon.
Yeah, and if you put the seraphim wings on a serpent-looking angel, you have a dragon.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Just as if you put wings on the serpent in Eden before it loses its limbs and things, you have, an animal type of dragon.
Yeah.
And so, that's all part of the kingship imagery and iconology of polytheism. And that's not a coincidence.
No. Of course, the Mesopotamians remembered that when kingship was first lowered from heaven, it was lowered at Eridu. That was the very first kings were located. And I noticed on your website, Genesis6conspiracy.com, and there'll be a link in the show notes, you've got a couple of these Ophidian figurines, these serpentine little terracotta figurines, which look reptilian, but with mammalian characteristics, mothers sometimes suckling their young. There have been about 150 of these found, and almost all of them have been found within 20 miles of Eridu.
Yeah. Yet not a coincidence. Right?
No.
And there were some of those found in the Ugaritic discoveries as well. And just as you have, the elongated skulls and other looks around the world. And, bring it forward to, let's say, the time of the Armana dynasty with Akhenaten, who is an important dragon king in the bloodlines of the Nephilim as these dynasties descend. Have a good look at King Akhenaten if you go to a Tutankhamun museum.
The deformed skull.
Yeah, so he's got the elongated skull, but he's also got those slanted eyes.
Yep.
He's got those very high cheekbones, that extended chin, and is very serpentine looking as a viper face. And this is, a couple thousand years after the birth of the original Nephilim. Well, and some of these traits are still coming through.
And the other thing that surprised me about this, and I didn't expect to find this when I was researching the what scholars call the Ubaid culture, which is pre-Nimrod.
Yes.
It's, say, about 4,000 BC and earlier to about 10,000 BC. And they found that all across the ancient Near East, what we today know as Iraq, Syria, the Levant, Lebanon, Israel, Jordan, almost everybody was doing something to form their children's heads into cones. They couldn't write. Yes. They hadn't invented writing yet, but they were all creating these cone heads. Why were they? I mean, I can only speculate that they're trying to emulate a look that they thought was the physical ideal. What is your research found?
Oh, there's no doubt that the priests and the nobility would want to emulate their kings and their gods. The thing that they couldn't do with their binding of the skulls to create that elongated look, they couldn't make them bigger.
Right, true.
Which the true ones with the true Nephilim or Titans and the gods would have produced and had. Right.
The cranial mass was larger instead of just deformed.
Yeah, exactly. And so when we bring that back to Eridu, I mean, this was where the temple of Eridu, as you mentioned, was, right? And I'm not sure whether that's the city of Enoch, son of Cain. It might be, and I know David Rohl says that, but if you look phonetically, you know, Erech and Uruk and Hanuk are more phonetically closer. I'm not saying that that's the case, but I think there's a connection there. And all of those cities are tightly grouped, right?
They're very close.
And so they would have been interchangeable. And so also Eridu is the place where a lot of researchers now think that the Tower of Babel was recreated.
Right. That's my view.
Yeah. And also there was a temple on the second restoration of Eridu after the flood of Enki, erected at the bottom of the ziggurat, according to Sumerian legends, for the meteors that hit the ocean to cause the flood. And so when I talked about those conflagration of events, understand the meteors and the Pleiades, star constellation allegories play heavily in all cultures around the world for the catalyst for the flood that hit the oceans, caused the boiling over of the water, then going up and then the rain coming down, and then there's volcanoes and earthquakes. And again, there's a very, very interesting character out of some Sumerian legends called King Emarakor out of, I think it's the Lord of Arada and Inertus Pride, which talks about a similar building of the Babel ziggurat at Eridu, and complete with dispersion of the languages afterwards.
It records all of the basic elements of the Tower of Babel story, yes.
Yeah, and if you look at, you know, Nimrod coming out of Hebrew, you've got NMR without the vowels, right?
Then
if you look at ancient Sumerian and very close in Akkadian, I think is the other language where you have a car coming out of Enmur car as hunter, and Nimrod was the hunter.
Mighty hunter before the Lord, right?
Yeah, you get the wordplay as Nimrod the hunter there.
Yeah.
And so there's a close analogy to that being the case, and it's the same generation being recorded.
Second generation after the flood, right.
Yeah, as you know, now the timelines of secular history and the biblical chronology don't quite mesh up. But if you accept that, they may never set up in terms of how secular are doing history, and for perhaps contrived reasons, and just let's set that aside and just say, let's look at the other facts. They pretty much become the same individual, I think.
Yeah, yeah. When you read the Enmerkar and the Lord of Arata, what he was trying to do, he was trying to do two things. One was to build a glorious temple to the goddess Inanna, who is Ishtar, and I know that you deal with her in your book.
Yes.
But the other, and the main thing, I think, was that he was trying to build up the temple to Anki, which he wanted to make it a glorious mountain, the abode of the gods.
Yes.
Which is an artificial. Go ahead.
And in Akkadian, as the language comes down and all of the Mesopotamian language sort of come, mythologies and legends come out of the ancient Sumerian tradition, you have Babel, which is understood as confusion of languages in Hebrew. But in Akkadian, Bab is gate and El is God.
Gate of the gods,
right. A gateway to the gods? Were they trying to bring fallen angels back or somehow bring them out of the abyss? We're not real sure. But you start to wonder, right?
Yeah, yeah. Or create an artificial holy mountain, which when you look at Ezekiel 28 as Eden being the original holy mountain from which humanity was barred because of the rebellion of Adam and Eve, they wanted to create apparently an artificial holy mountain where humankind once again had access to the throne of God, or at least access to the gods. But whatever it was serious enough that Yahweh himself had to come down and personally stop it.
Yeah, and that's such a significant point, because not only were ziggurats known in the ancient world, and again, we see it as a tower in the biblical account, but towers, ziggurats, and pyramids were understood as the same type of structure, mm-hmm. with the same meanings, right? So all of a sudden say, okay, now that starts to make sense, even though we call it the Tower of Babel. Was it a spiral tower, or, you know, that still came to a point, or was it more pyramid shape? We don't know, but it is a representation of holy mountains in the Sumerian tradition. And what's important about that is you have Mount Hermon, where Enoch records the Nephilim being created. So one wonders whether or not they wanted to have a second incursion there or not.
Right.
And then when you understand that holy mountains are a prehistory constant in all cultures around the world, whether it's the Olympus in Greek mythology or the seven sacred mountains as they're known in other mythologies. Again, it goes back to that seven sort of cult centers ruling from holy mountains. All of the imagery just seems to come together. Mm. You get me excited here, Derek.
Yeah, no, the information is tracking side by side. And what really excites me is when I can find a secular scholar who's done this research and documents something without grasping the spiritual or supernatural significance. A scholar named Edward Lipinski about 40 years ago put out a paper about the abode of El, and concluded that the mount of assembly for the chief Canaanite god El was in fact Mount Hermon. Okay, well, that makes the transfiguration of Jesus even more significant than it already was.
Yeah, and El was such a violent, brutal god of Canaan, right? It was just, and he consorted and produced so many Nephilim with so many different women in the different accounts. And for people who aren't familiar with El, this is not El of the Bible. This is not Elohim or El Shaddai.
Right.
El is a generic name for God, right? In the old language, whether it's EL or IL or ILU or the very, or AL, or there's a whole bunch of different, from the different transliterations of the same word. And he was also the father of Baal or Baal.
Mm-hmm.
It was the father of Molech, which were the gods that were going to basically plague the Israelites all throughout their history. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, definitely.
Again, all of this is connected.
Yeah, definitely not the God of the Bible. There's one Canaanite myth where El has a little too much to drink, and according to the Canaanite myth, he wallows in his filth and urine, and that is not the God of the Bible. Well, let's try to bring this up, because, you know, we could talk for hours here, but I like to keep these to a manageable length for listeners and viewers.
Sure.
Let's bring this into the present day. How does all of this ancient mythology and the interaction of these angelic watchers translate into the beliefs of the secret societies today, and what is their end game? What are their goals?
Yeah, big question. Let me try and do this as quick as I can. So first thing is, let's just underline for context that, you know, I always like to go to Jesus as to what he says first on everything. And so he points us in a direction for his second coming and the signs of the end of the age, that it will be like the days of Noah. So, and we don't get a whole bunch of context in there, you know, other than the typical, they were going on eating, drinking, marrying as they did. But if we understand the whole world of the time of Noah, both before and after the flood, because Noah lived for 350 years after the flood, we have to take in accounts, and that would suggest Nephilim are going to be part of. And if we look into Babel, which is part of the Babylon religion of the end time, and look at what happened at Babel and start layering in some other context that comes from outside sources, and particularly the secret societies, because that's the question that you're really asking here, is they believed that the seven sacred sciences, they protected those in 36,525 vaults that were hidden under the pyramids, the knowledge of Enoch.
That's a lot of vaults.
Yeah, and the two pillars that they put it on had some of the basic information and knowledge of the seven sciences and where to find them. So they believe, and that was done by Lamech and their sons to protect that knowledge, because they knew the flood was coming. And then Hermes, which is another significant patriarch, as is Tubal-Cain in Masonic society and hierarchy, finds these pillars, finds the knowledge, takes that back to Babel, or not yet Babel, but to Nimrod, to redevelop the seven sciences, with Babel being the first manifestation of the fifth science, which is geometry, or as they call inside the craft, masonry. So they build the city, and they build the tower, right? And in Masonic belief system and Aztec belief system, they believe Nimrod was the first grand master
of
Masonry after the flood.
Right. Yeah. In fact, I wrote a paper, and I wouldn't call it academic. It's not peer reviewed or anything like that. But yep. I wrote a pretty well footnoted paper, just drawing from the writings of Freemasons, so that it wasn't me speculating.
And Albert Mackey on the history of Freemasonry lays out all of these legends in a written form. Right.
Yeah, that's who they're venerating. It's not Solomon or Hiram Abiff. It's Nimrod. Yeah.
Exactly. And so what we learn is somehow the Nephilim crossed the flood, the religions crossed the flood,
mm-hmm.
right? And the secret societies crossed the flood, and we know not all the angels that were put in the abyss. So you've got fallen angels, and you also have demons. So you have this same sort of organization crossing the flood to taint the early post-Diluvian world, our whole history, and are still working together today to bring about the end time, because they want to bring about the end time, and they want to bring it out as the new Atlantis or the new age, and that's why you need to understand Atlantean mythology to understand where they're coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And they want this rendezvous with destiny.
Hmm.
And so everything that they're doing today in terms of world government and getting ready for it, even though it won't happen until the restrainer is removed, they would bring it on sooner than later. The only thing that's preventing them is the restrainer, in my opinion. And so they also believe that the Antichrist will come from the bloodlines of these Nephilim, who, again, usurp the kingships after the flood.
So their goal, then, is to bring back the domination over the world of these the Watchers who reigned before the flood and bring them back to...
And that's why Thessalonians, when it gives us a time frame of the end time and the rapture, talks about a rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same rebellion that happened at Babel. It's the same rebellion that happened before the flood, right? So they're going to try and convince the people of the earth through multiple deceptions to rebel against the God of the universe and to fight for their freedom, just as you do in Star Wars.
So,
as an analogy, because it's got that good versus evil dualism mysticism.
Right.
And in that inside out allegory, it's the empire that they would classify as the organization of the God of the Bible.
So people who are rising up as part of this rebellion think that they're trying to overthrow this despot when, in fact, they're fighting on the side of the Antichrist.
Yes. They believe that. They are the children of light. That's why Freemasons call themselves the sons of light. And light is a core allegory in their belief system, just as Satan masquerades or disguises himself as an angel of light. And that the God of the Bible is evil, and the religion of Christianity and Judaism is also evil.
Okay, I can still hear you, so you can keep on talking. We'll just put up a still shot here. I guess your camera has decided to take a nap on us, but that's all right. We can still hear you.
Yeah.
But 2 Thessalonians 2, beginning at verse 3, and this puts this verse in a whole new context. Let no one deceive you in any way, for that day will not come, meaning the day of Jesus Christ gathering the elect, gathering the believers to him. That day will not come unless the rebellion comes first. And there are many who would say the apostasy comes first, which is how other English translations word it.
Yep.
This is the English Standard Version, ESV.
Yep.
And the man of lawlessness, the Antichrist, is revealed, the son of destruction, who opposes and exalts himself against every so-called God, exalts himself against every so-called.
Yes.
So he's going to present himself as, hey, I'm here, I'm the Messiah.
Yes. Antichrist.
You know, the sad thing is that there are a lot of... I'm trying to be diplomatic here, but I think our Jewish brothers and sisters who are looking for a geopolitical savior, I go into this in the book, The Great Inception, laying out a what I think is a plausible end time scenario where Israel is facing an existential crisis and somebody rises up and leads them to a victory and says, you know, and they would see that figure as a messianic figure, whether they
Absolutely.
Call him that or not. Those who are looking for the embodiment of the a physical return of the Mashiach would likely see him as Mashiach ben Joseph and then Mashiach ben David.
Sure.
But there are a lot of Christians who would see him that way too.
Yeah, and then if this person plays, let's say, a larger role in forming of the world government and also permits the Jewish people to begin their sacrifices on the wing of the temple again, as it says in Daniel, then they absolutely would recognize it, or at least hope that this is their Messiah, and they would say, well, who else could it be, right? Yeah. And that's part of the end-time deceptions, I believe. And what's really important about all of this, not just the deception of the Jews, is the deception of other people that around the earth, that they're going to actually be told that the God of the Bible is the evil God, but is no stronger than Satan is, right? That in their dualist belief system, that's that yin and the yang that's in perfect balance, good and evil, that's always at odds with each other. And so they have an ability to win their freedom because they believe from their side that it's the God of the Bible who enslaves humankind in the physical realm just to worship him, right? And wants to keep knowledge away from them. So it's like Star Wars. If you want your freedom, you have to rebel because they're called the rebels and fight for your freedom.
And the irony, of course, is that the freedom that they're fighting for is actually the ultimate enslavement. This would be the greatest double cross in history.
Yes, absolutely. And that's why people will be gnashing their teeth.
Huh. Wow. Well, you know, there's so much in here. You've got, my goodness, 97 chapters in the book. And there is so much in here to cover that we, again, we could talk for hours. And I think that we're going to have to do more programs on this, because if people are enjoying this as much as I am, they're going to want to do more. But like I said, just as a courtesy, I try to keep these from going so long that people have to sit down and make appointments in their schedule to listen or watch. But let me just throw out one last one, I guess, as a tease here. And I'm picking this because these are names that appear very prominently in the fictional series that Sharon is writing, and she's smart enough to have picked these deliberately. Okay, the names Sinclair and Stewart.
Yes.
What's the significance?
Well, those are very, very important names as you go back into the bloodlines and into the secret societies. And so there's a Zion that's taking place as part of their Zion allegory. And Zion is like grafting in of a new shoot or new bloodline. And in the other part of the meeting, it's noble bloodlines and the firstborn son. So so Zion and Zion is a connection. And the reason why that's important is because you have Sinclair, which actually is the Scottish version of St. Clair.
St. Clair, right.
Right. And Sinclairs are the ones who protected the Knights Templar after the fall in 1307 to restart them as Freemasons, right? And the St. Clairs were part of the original Knights Templar, where they take their history back from, right? And so St. Clair, they've been part of the Templar and Freemasonic movement throughout history. And they're a part of the bloodlines that go back through de Bullion, because they're all intermarried in this group, back to Dagobert, who's the last survivor of the Merovingian dynasty,
right.
And then back into prehistory and all these Nephilim bloodlines and other ones that you know, I talk about extensively in the book. And what was the other name?
Stewart.
Well, the Stewart dynasty, it shoots up after the Bruce dynasty doesn't have a male heir, right? And so the daughter marries into the Stewart family, which is a very, very important bloodline family as well, but it becomes what they call the Unicorn Dynasty. And they call it the Unicorn Dynasty because not only is it an allegory of unicorn, which is in the King James Bible, which, you know, basically should just say a wild beast when I take that back to Hebrew, but it's a unification of all the royal bloodlines that couldn't be more ennobled at that time. And one of the leading candidates for where Antichrist will come from that pedigree. And the only other one that would be equivalent to it, in which they're directly connected back through the Plantagenet all the way back, is the Merovingian dynasty, which was the most ennobled bloodlines of that time. And so very, very important to keep an eye on the Stuarts. And, of course, the Stuart kingship, they believed in this divine right to rule, which was the Nephilim ideology, that they were empowered by the gods
when
to rule as their representatives.
Kingship was lowered from heaven. It was lowered first at Eridu.
Yes. Yeah. And they believe through these bloodlines, they also have the rights through Benjamite bloodlines that they take back to King Saul in the Scion of bloodlines, where Joshua gives the rights to Jerusalem, and the King of Jerusalem title that you would have heard with the Habsburgs, which were part of these bloodlines, and now with the King of Spain, is that title that they connect back through their Benjamite heritage to what Joshua did and awarded Jerusalem to that bloodline. That Antichrist will announce himself at the abomination as King of Jerusalem.
Right? So Jerusalem was part of the territory of Benjamin.
Yeah. Well, Joshua awards that to Benjamin.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
As their inheritance. And so they connect that from the Bible as having King Saul bloodlines to being the rights to Jerusalem, which will be part of the pedigree of Antichrist.
Okay. The Amorite, and I contend that the Amorites are a lot more important to human history than we've ever realized, too. They were divided into tribes just like the Israelites were.
Yeah, they had many, many tribes, right? Whether it's
one of their main tribal confederations was called the Binu Yamina, the Benjaminites. And they're one of the main tribes of the Benjaminites during the time of and just before the time of the Exodus was a tribe named for the moon god, Yarik. They were the Yariku. And when you transliterate Hebrew into English, of course, you swap the Y for the J, and that's where you get the name of Jericho.
Yeah, and Jericho was the city of the moon.
Yes. There were two principal gods in the early days of the Amorites. One was El, who we've already talked about. The other was the moon god. There were two other main cult centers of the moon god in Mesopotamia. One was Ur, the city of Ur, but the other was Haran, which was where Abram was called from by Yahweh. And now this is where the research is going for, I think, what'll be one of my next books. What's the symbol on top of the very tallest building in Mecca? It's the crescent moon. It is all
connected. And because that's been adopted into Islam, even though they took that crescent moon after conquering Constantinople.
Right, right.
It was originally part of there, but they've matched that up with another where they have their god that they call Allah,
mm-hmm.
Which was also in ancient times known as a moon god and or Sin, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. Sin and Yarik and what was the other one? Nana back in ancient Sumer.
Yes. Yeah.
But again, I'm just thinking, okay, the Benjaminites, Jerusalem, Benjaminites, moon god worship today. Okay. I'm going to have to go home and write some more notes here, Gary. This has been phenomenal stuff. I'm going to get your book before I go home. It's available on Kindle, Barnes & Noble, and, of course, hard copy. Where do people – do you have a preferred place where people would go to buy the Genesis 6 conspiracy?
Yeah, obviously it's also available at Amazon.com and any other online bookstore. But you can get a signed copy if you like through my website.
Okay.
And there's also connections on the website to go to BarnesandNoble.com and Amazon.com, and also the Kindle format as well. You have a connection there, or just go right on to Amazon.
Yeah.
And it's available through any bookstore. They may not have it on the shelf, but it is distributed to those stores. So it's readily available if they ask for it.
Yeah, they can get it within a few days.
If people want to follow me, I'm on Facebook under Gary Wayne with two Genesis 6 conspiracy pages, and also on Twitter at GaryWayne63, at GaryWayne63.
Okay. Well, 97 chapters. I think we might have touched on maybe about five or six of them so far, so we're going to have to do this again. But the website is Genesis6conspiracy.com. You'll find a link below this video if you're watching it, or at the website if you're listening to this, VFTB.net. This is fascinating stuff, Gary. And again, it's what I thought, and I think it's why people were telling me and been nudging me for months. You need to talk to him because we're looking at different things, but following parallel track.
Yes.
All right, Gary, thank you very much for your time. We'll have to do this again.
Terrific.
Check the show notes at vftb.net, and you'll also find them below this video if you happen to be watching at youtube.com/Derek Gilbert. The book is an impressive work. In size, if nothing else, but the content is excellent too. It's about 900 pages, 97 chapters altogether. It is available for Kindle and ebook as well. So if carrying around something that's really big and heavy is an issue, well, consider getting the ebook version. I'll put links to where you can find a copy of the Genesis 6 conspiracy in the show notes. Coming up, we got a couple of things to announce here, which are pretty exciting. This is turning out to be a busy year, and busy in a good way. Skywatch TV, we're in the process of, getting a new studio. We're in the process of designing it right now, and that will lead to the launch of the women's program that Sharon will host later this year. We've got some other ideas for programs in the works that hopefully will be able to take advantage of that new studio, which will look a little less newsy than the Skywatch TV main studio that we use now for the daily updates and the weekly interview program. But a piece of property came up available locally here at a really, really reasonable price. So trying to be good stewards of what's been entrusted to us. And trust me when I say that like the building we're in now, it is far cheaper to expand into this space than to try to build a new space. So we're very blessed in that this became available to us. And plus, being local here, it is, being close by the building, which will continue to serve as the warehouse for Defender Publishing. Nice to keep everything close by and have access to getting back and forth without any difficulty. It's about 2 minutes away from where I'm sitting right now. So that's one of the developments. Of course, you know that later this year, although we've only talked about it once because it's still a ways off, we don't want you to forget about the Blessed Hope Prophecy Forum. This is being produced by our friends at Prophecy Watchers, Gary Stearman and Bob Ulrich. Of course, Skywatch TV is one of the co-sponsors of this conference, and a number of us will be speaking at this conference. This is coming up October 13th through the 15th in Norman, Oklahoma, which is just outside Oklahoma City, home of Oklahoma University, OU. Speakers at this, and there are 33 speakers coming to this conference. The Embassy Suites in Norman, a new venue for this particular conference, and it is supposed to be just an excellent layout for this conference. We will have more people there and more speakers, 33 speakers there, including Gary Stearman, Tom Horn, of course, me and Sharon, Josh Peck from here at Skywatch TV, L.A. Marzulli, Dr. Randall Price, Bill Salas, Rabbi Jonathan Kahn, Tim Alberino, Pastor Billy Crone, Carl Teichrib, one of our favorite speakers, an excellent researcher. Glad that he's coming back this year. Dr. Ken Johnson, who is a soft-spoken, but when he speaks, he's got something to say. Looking forward to seeing him again. Dr. Michael Lake, our friend from nearby here in the Ozarks. And Lieutenant Colonel Bob McGinnis will be there as well. Tim Mahoney, the filmmaker behind Patterns of Evidence, the film about the historicity of the Exodus, and many others. You'll find information and registration at prophecywatchers.com. The end of this month, of course, is the Hear the Watchman 2017 conference in Dallas, God's Great Gathering. That is March 31st through April 2nd at the Hilton DFW Lakes Conference Center in Grapevine, Texas. Speakers there include Pastor Carl Gallops, L.A. Marzulli, Russ Dizdar, Dr. Michael Lake, Josh Peck. Sharon and I will be leading a session, or at least part of a session, I should say, on couples in ministry, along with Josh Tolley and his new bride, Pastor Paul Begley and his wife Heidi, Coach Dave Dobbenmeyer and his bride. We'll be just sharing what it's like to work side by side with your spouse, and how we do that in a biblical way. And we've got some ideas on scriptures we can use to support that, but we need to communicate with the other couples in the group. But we're looking forward to that. Of course, meeting John B. Wells as a longtime radio guy, that for me will be a lot of fun. If you can be there, that will be great. Look forward to seeing you there. Save $20 off your registration by using the promo code SKYWATCH at checkout. The promo code SKYWATCH for registration if you can make it to the conference. If not, there is a live streaming option. All of the sessions will be streamed live and available online for 30 days after the conference. You can go back and watch stuff again or see something you missed. Cost is $39 if you sign up for the live stream by March 22nd. That's by March 22nd, just about a week and a half from today. And you can save 5% on that by using the promo code Gilbert5. That's Gilbert and the numeral 5 at checkout. Now, after March 22nd, registration for the live stream goes up to $49. So do take advantage of the $10 discount by getting in early and the additional 5% with the promo code Gilbert5. And then, just announced today, the True Legends Conference coming to Branson, Missouri, here in our backyard, September 15th through the 17th. This one will be notable if only for the fact this will be the first conference I will have attended at which Steve Quayle will be speaking. This is put on by Gen 6 Productions, which, of course, is Steve Quayle and Timothy Alberino. They will be, I guess, the headliners, if you will. Steve Quayle, Timothy Alberino, Tom Horn, who doesn't speak at conferences anymore, but he owed Steve a favor. L.A. Marzulli, Dr. Micah Lake, and me. Anselm P. Rambla, also Pastor David Langford, will be there as well. The Mansion Theater in Branson. This is a little different venue because this is a essentially a theater that musical acts or stage productions will normally use. So the seating is going to be a lot more comfortable than you might be used to in some of the conferences that are held in hotels. In fact, I think the Oak Ridge Boys play about 20 shows a year at the Mansion Theater. And they, in fact, they'll be there the week following our conference. Again, the dates, September 15th through the 17th, Mansion Theater, Branson, Missouri, the True Legends Conference. And you can register online effective today at Gen 6 Conferences. And you spell that out, no numeral, G-E-N-S-I-X, Gen6Conferences.com. And we hope to see you there for that. Please join our Bible study. Sharon and I host it every week at GilbertHouse.org. The Gilbert House Fellowship, an hour of the Old Testament, hour of the New Testament, and we're getting into the book of Revelation now. So things are about to get interesting, really interesting, on the New Testament side. We'll post that every Sunday for your download, no charge, at gilberthouse.org. Appreciate you taking the time to give us a review or a like, iTunes, Stitcher, wherever else fine podcasts are sold, and of course, like us at Facebook, facebook.com/viewfromthebunker. View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives, 4.0 international license. Opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod. The opening introduction by D.C. Good. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.